Do you wish that you had more time to spend doing the things you love? Maybe you want longer weekends with your family, or maybe you have a side hustle that you want to start pursuing and try to monetize. My guest today is Joe Sanok. He's a podcaster, he's an author, but he's also a consultant that helps businesses and entrepreneurs scale their results by increasing their productivity. And he wrote a book called Thursday is the New Friday. I have 10 copies of this book that I'm going to give away to the first 10 listeners that reach out to me. All you have to do is rate and review the podcast, take a screenshot, and email it to me, ryan@ryanshekel.com. The first 10 people that send me a screenshot of their rating and review are going to have Joe's book, Thursday is the New Friday, mailed directly to them immediately. So again, if you want to increase your productivity, please rate and review the podcast, email me, ryan@ryanshekel.com, send me your address, and I will immediately mail you, the first 10 people to do so, a copy of Joe's book, Thursday's New Friday. Now, if you don't get a copy of the book, enjoy this episode because Joe is a phenomenal guest. He's got an amazing story, and all the tips that he talks about today are super impactful and will help you grow and scale your business, whatever it is. Without further ado, let's get started. Welcome to the Every Breath Counts podcast. I'm Ryan Shekel, health enthusiast, amateur ultra runner, and award-winning business consultant. And each week, I interview experts and leaders about their stories and strategies on how to optimize your mind, your body, your career, and your life so that you can make every breath count. Thank you for investing your time in the show and yourself. Now, let's get started. Tim Ferriss said, "Focus on being productive instead of busy." And Albert Einstein said, "Strive not to be a success, but rather to be of value." My guest today is Joe Sanok. Joe is a counselor turned entrepreneur, TEDx speaker, and author. He hosts a top 50 podcast and just released his newest book, Thursday is the New Friday. We talk about how to increase productivity and achieve more to create the freedom and autonomy to create your own schedule. Joe shares his practical advice on starting and growing an entrepreneurial business and living a purpose-driven life. Whether you want to create more free time to pursue your passions or find time to monetize those passions, this episode is for you. And if this is your first time here, welcome and thank you for tuning in. Be sure to click the subscribe button to stay up to date with all the latest episodes. If you found this episode inspiring, educational, or just entertaining, I would be grateful if you gave us a 5-star rating wherever you listen and tag me on Instagram at Every Breath Counts Podcast with any feedback. Get ready to take your Fridays back with Joe Sanok. Joe Sanok, thanks for taking time to join the podcast, brother.
Oh, I am so excited to be here.
You have got a ton going on in your life. You've built, you've grown, you've sold a mental well-being counseling practice. You're a consultant, a TEDx speaker. You have a top 50 podcast, and you recently authored the book, Thursday is the New Friday. So from the outside looking in, it seems as though you epitomize hustle culture. But your book helps people increase productivity while working less hours. Do you really only work 4 days a week?
I actually work less than 4 days a week, except for when I'm in the middle of a book launch.
Tell me more about that.
You know, I mean, I when I left my full-time job in 2015, that first summer, I realized I had my whole schedule. It was up to me again as to what I wanted to do. So I did an experiment that first summer, not working Fridays, just to do it as an experiment, just to see. Like, the world's not going to fall apart in one summer of not working Fridays. And so June of 2015 was the best financial month that my business had ever had. July was better than June and August was better than July. And so that fall of 2015, I said the 4-day work week is going to be what I commit to moving forward, unless there's some numbers that, you know, we stop hitting. It was still an experiment, but hey, I'm going to keep that as my schedule and just see what happens. And then over time, I've continued to do time experiments. So from September of 2020 until late April of 2021, rather than have my kids do Zoom school, I took them on the road to live in national parks. And so there were weeks at a time that I had no internet access. And so we planned ahead for that with my assistant to know that in the Grand Canyon, for example, you just can't get a signal. And so being an online marketer type podcaster, I had to really figure out my schedule so that I didn't just lose my business during that time. And so was able to shift my job around to be able to do this epic adventure while also keeping the podcast and the book launch and all of that going.
That's so cool. And that's actually something that I talked to my wife about last year as well during the pandemic. And she looked at me and she's like, okay, so hold on. We don't have to be in the office. The kids don't have to be in school. Technology, you can get it pretty much everywhere. If you're in the Grand Canyon, then maybe not, like, you're logged right in, but you can still have access to technology. So why are we tied to the house? And I know it's a global pandemic, but we should be free. We should be able to go anywhere and do what we're doing. I mean, how'd your kids do with school in the Grand Canyon and trying to do this remote learning as you're out exploring the world?
Yeah. So I road schooled them. So we took them out of traditional education, had a tutor out of Chicago for particularly my oldest daughter. She had struggled with reading and writing. So she had an hour tutoring every day, 5 days a week. It was crazy expensive, but totally worth it. She went up 2 grade levels in her reading in about 6 months. So fit learning out of Chicago is insane when it comes to just, you know, helping your kids get up to speed in regards to reading and spelling. And then did this online math program called Beast Academy that's super cheap, but it's this cheesy guy that he like hams it up and the kids loved him. But other than that, you know, it was natural learning experiences. And so, for example, I remember we were on our way to Carlsbad Caverns in southern New Mexico. And on the way to places, I would have the girls watch videos about that place to learn about that and then have them teach me what we should do. And I remember my 10-year-old, she was just like, we need to take the natural entrance. If we take the elevator, we miss a third of it. And here's the things that we're going to see in the natural entrance. We're going to see like stalactites, stalagmites, all these things. And then there's these unique crystals that look like, you know, straws. And she was so excited to teach me what she had just learned on some YouTube videos on the way there. And so now when she learns about caves in a book, you know, in fifth grade in traditional education, she has a memory there. She knows what it's like along the New Mexico and Arizona border. She's seen border police checking RVs. And we talked about, you know, undocumented immigrants and, you know, how that's tough. And, you know, it's a complex issue. And so for them to have lived this and to say, hey, I know where New Mexico is. I know where Arizona is. I know, you know, what saguaro cacti look like. They now love learning because they've experienced so much of the things they're talking about in the classroom.
That makes so much sense. And you talk a lot in the beginning of your book, Thursday's the New Friday, about curiosity. And I think what you're describing, it really resonates with that because it seems as though you saw a problem, right, during the pandemic that you had a curiosity about. Can we educate our kids? Can we work and not be at home? And you had this curiosity, it was a question. And you do talk about bridging the gap between curiosity and having an answer. And that's where a lot of these businesses come from. That's where productivity can come from in so many ways. So talk to me more about, you know, curiosity and how important it is to optimizing your workload and really minimizing the time you spend.
Yeah. So the other day, my nieces who live in the same neighborhood, you know, they're 3 and 6. They came over playing with my 7 and 10-year-old daughter. So 4 little girls outside screaming and running around. And I'm watching the 4 of them and I'm kind of inside, I think, doing dishes or something. And it gets super quiet. Like, that is not normal for 4 little girls. So I go outside and all 4 of them are standing around this dead mouse. And they're like, should we poke it? Oh, that's not really nice to the dead mouse. We shouldn't poke it. How do you think it died? They were saying all these things. You know, do you think an owl will eat it? Do owls eat live mice or only dead mice? Should we bury it? Do mice want funerals? What do you say at a mouse funeral? I mean, this ridiculous conversation. But it got me thinking about curiosity and how when you're a kid, you are constantly sorting out is this a normal thing in the world, or is this outside of that? You know, it's the first time you see a rainbow, the first time you see a car accident, the first time someone treats you poorly. You're constantly saying, wait, is this normal? Like, do people always treat you like junk on the first day of school, or is this an outsider kind of thing? And so we tend to lose that as adults, where we think we understand how the world works. And if we put ourselves in situations that disrupt that norm, that's what effective leaders do. They're constantly curious. And so whether it's looking at a new product or a Facebook ads campaign, it's not a loss if we say spend $1,000 on a Facebook ads campaign and nobody clicks through. Of course, who wants that to happen? But we can then say we just learned some copy that doesn't work. We just learned some images that don't work. We learned a lot of things about our audience from this, and let's remain curious and say, huh, how about that? There's a quote in the book that that the word eureka isn't what we're searching for, but really the best thing that we can say is, well, that's interesting. Why did that happen? And to just keep digging into it. I know that even when I approach my audience, you know, when we're looking at launching a new product, and I walk through this whole framework in the book, but we don't start with, here's the product I want to build. No, we enter into conversations with our audience in a curiosity type of way, where we're asking them, what are the struggles? What are the pains? If we made a magical product that solved all of that for you, like, what would that look like? How much would you pay for that? And so just going into it and saying, hey, I've got this audience that I can just say, what is it that you would want? If you were launching a podcast, what would that look like? I remember when I was launching Podcast Launch School to support people, I went through the three questions to ask formula I talk about in the book, and was talking to these top level people that had paid over $10,000 in consulting with me, thinking they're going to want some e-course to start some podcast. As I asked them about the pain that they were going through in launching a podcast, when I asked them about what they wish that I would create and how much they would pay, they told me, Joe, you know how to do a podcast. You have a whole team. I would love to just show up, record a podcast, and have your whole team just take it over. And so I'm thinking $500 e-course. And then when I asked them, how much would you pay for that? They're like, I don't know, $18,000 or more. What? So then I turn around and I pitch back to them, here's what we're offering. And within 2 weeks, I've sold five spots at 18K. Like, I had almost $100,000 month that month, just because I asked questions and I was curious. And we all frequently kind of create our things that we think that our audience wants and then jam them into that box versus let's just ask them some questions and be curious.
Yeah, that's crazy. And what a great example of kind of getting to know. And I cut my teeth in the sales industry. And one of the things that we're taught when you're training in the sales industry, specifically in the program that I trained in, is continuously getting to know and really understanding what your customers and your clients might want. And I think Henry Ford most famously said, if I gave my customers what they asked for, I would have made a faster horse. And it's true, but at the same time, there's this balance of a lot of the new sales reps we've trained have said, well, I don't want to expose a weakness, right? Like, I don't want them to question my client. I don't want them to question what may be wrong with the product. And we have to shift their thinking and say, no, you want to know exactly what their pain points are. You want to know exactly what their concern is, because it might highlight more of an opportunity. And it sounds like that's what you really uncovered by just continuously being curious and asking more and more questions. I mean, is that true?
Yeah. I mean, I think that we are so far past the information age and are definitely in the implementation age, where people just want to do things faster. They understand the value of their time. And if you can say, hey, I'm moving forward in an imperfect way. This is the first time we've done the Done For You podcasting, for example. We want to get as much feedback from you as possible. We're going to over deliver. So one thing I did is when all those people signed up, I had a monthly call that I did with all of them. And we just sorted through, like, where do you feel stuck? It was questions I knew I would get, but I hadn't said that there's a mastermind group included in this. It was just added on top for free. And so when you work with your clients and start to say, okay, where are the pain points? How do I over deliver? How do I make sure that we're adjusting and changing over time? That's where you really get to know the kind of secret sauce behind it for your audience. I think it's when people show up and pretend like they're the guru when deep down they know that they're not. that just like people see through that stuff. And so, you know, if you're doing a beta launch, like when we launched our membership community a number of years ago, the first group, I said, listen, we're going to charge $99 a month eventually for this. But if you come in this first beta group, you'll be $55 a month as long as you stay in this group. You'll never pay more than $55 a month for what we're offering you. But the first quarter, we're going to screw a lot up. We went through, I think, with 9 webinar platforms in 2 months. I mean, how annoying is that? People would show up and their iPad wouldn't work on that platform. And we'd reach out to the platform and they'd say, no, we haven't integrated with iPads. We're like, what? Who are you? That's ridiculous. It was like 2019. They rolled with it because it wasn't perfect and we were building it as we went. But we had told them all that. We anchored it in and said, this is why you're getting it for $55 a month. Tell us where we're doing a bad job so that we can change it and adjust it to make it the perfect community for you.
I think that's really hard for a lot of people. It's really hard for me too, because in some way, like if you're selling a service or if you want to be considered an expert, you really do feel like you have to know everything. But at the same time, I mean, you don't want to be just crippled by the fact that you don't have it all figured out. So like, how do you work through that balance of like, I know I have value, what I'm doing has value, what I know has value, but I may not have a fully created platform system solution. How do you kind of bring that together and say, where do we put this in? And I guess this is more of an entrepreneurial question, right? Like, how do you monetize value and how do you organize it to become a company?
Yeah, I think what you're talking about is the big shift away from the industrialists. You know, in 1926, Henry Ford gave us the 40-hour work week. That's awesome. That's less than 100 years ago. And people were working 10 to 14 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week. It was needed at the time. But what the industrialists gave us was everything's a blueprint. Everything is this assembly line. People, you just plug them in. They're like robots. And you set up one system and you set it and forget it. That model is clearly dead. We don't think that way anymore, even though those influences are still in our culture. Instead, what we're moving into is an evolutionary model. It's one where we grow and shape and adapt our companies over time. And so even the way that I approach my staff, I ask them 3 questions every single year. First is, what are you doing that you absolutely love and want to keep doing? Second, what are you doing right now that you hate and you don't want to keep doing? And third, where are you growing where you need extra training? And I've had people that started at the bottom where they're just doing Instagram graphics that, you know, Sam is now my chief marketing officer. She's taken all sorts of YouTube training and marketing and oversees a whole team because she grew and adapted over time. And so even the idea that we have to be this guru who has it, quote, all figured out, nobody wants someone that has it all figured out because that shows that they're not adaptable. Those types of consultants, I would say, are outdated, where they're not growing and adjusting over time. Instead, you just want to be a few clicks ahead of your audience. So, you know, if you're a couple steps ahead and you're saying, hey, you know, I'm doing these things, it's the things that you want to do, let me show you how I did it. It's going to cost X number of dollars. And you approach it that way, I think that's so much easier to sell, because then if you change course and you say, you know what, I'm sick of podcasting, I want to go into something else, you can say to your audience, here's how I made that decision. Here's why I think it's beneficial. Do you want to come along with me on that journey now? So now you're not just locked into that you have to be the person that fill in the blank, that's the only consulting you do. Instead, it's more organic. And it shows that we as people actually change over time, that our egos aren't so wrapped up into the products, but it's more our approach to life.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I was actually listening to a podcast that you did with Pat Flynn, and he talks a lot about that. I think when you guys spoke as well, of just getting into something and saying, you know what, I need to adapt. I need to change. This isn't necessarily what my initial kind of goal was. This is where I see the value that I'm bringing, even though I've already started in one direction. So for anyone that's looking to get into business for themselves, they want to get away from these industrialists that have created this 40-hour work week and, you know, quote, working for the man, I guess, and they want to start their own business. They know they have value. What are the 3 things that you would advise them before getting started that they need to either learn, figure out, or establish?
Yeah. So I would say when someone's first starting out, we first want to look at growing your specialty. Then we want to grow your audience. Then we want to grow your income. Too many people start with, oh my gosh, I got to replace this job. I got to make all this money. If you start with the money or the product, you're going to then squeeze people into that. And so starting with a specialty, when you choose a specialty that goes maybe 1 or 2 steps deeper than you think you should go, you can charge more and you can focus more on your expertise. And so for me, I started as a consultant who helped people start private practices, mostly from a private pay mentality. And so in the counseling world, there's people that bill insurance. So, you know, your regular health insurance, and there's people that don't bill insurance. So when I initially started, I was the private pay guy. Here's how you do that. Here's how you grow a practice. Because I was charging at that time $150 per counseling session, I could easily charge, you know, $300, $400 per hour for consulting within that space. Now, if you're teaching someone something general and you're showing them how to build a business where they can make $10 per smoothie they sell, you as a consultant can't really charge that much. Whereas if you get really specialized in and you're known as the Facebook ad specialist who helps former military people launch small businesses that are in the service sector, you're like the only person there, you know? And so you're able to then specialize and help out in a lot of other ways. As well, that learning where you're spending all that time in that specialty then allows you to just become an expert so much faster. So then the second part would be really focus on growing your audience. And I would say grow it in the space that you want to grow it. Where do you find fulfillment? Just the other day, I was having coffee with someone locally and she was kind of growing some space around women's health. And she said, I just hate social media. She's, you know, really into like nature and, you know, just hates being online, hates having her face out there, hates all of it. She's like, I just love writing. And I'm just like, then write, like do epic blog posts about women's health that dives in so deep that people are sharing it like crazy because there's nothing else out there. Write 3,000 word articles, write white papers, be the person that's known for writing about women's health and just go full tilt in that area that you like. And then if you notice after going as full tilt as you can, you don't have the audience you want, sure, then we can add the stuff you don't like. But let's start with, you know, life's too short to be doing all sorts of things that we hate doing. Let's just start with the stuff that we love. So like, for example, every report card as a child said, Joey talks to his neighbors too much. He's distracting other kids. I get paid to podcast now. I love talking. I love meeting new people like you. I love, you know, having people onto my show. It's super easy for me to just show up and have conversations with people. If I had to write 5,000 word articles every week, I could do it, but that's not what I love. And so I would say start in building your audience in that way and make sure you have a clear opt-in where people can, you know, get into an email course or in some way you can communicate with them. And then that last step, that's where you're going to start to talk to that audience and build out products that they want. We kind of address that side of it first. But I would really start on those first two as much as you can on the front end.
That makes so much sense. And it's crazy though, because a lot of times these new entrepreneurs are trying to do this as a side hustle, right? And that's where I now have questions of, okay, you're trying to work this 4-day work week, or you're trying to maybe optimize your productivity by taking a step back and doing a little bit less so that your focus is greater. But if everybody's trying to have the side hustle and they're trying to do more, how can they still take time for themselves and their family and work this consolidated type of work week?
Yeah, I think the average entrepreneur, the struggle that they have is there's always way more ideas than we have time to work on. Yeah. And usually they're ideas that we're excited about. Very few entrepreneurs are like, I'm going to create a business I hate. Usually it's, you know, I'm really excited about fill in the blank. And so for us, our struggle is, what sort of clear hard boundaries and soft boundaries can we set around our time? So say you have a full-time job or a part-time job, and then you also have a side hustle. What does that look like? Are you dedicating a particular amount of time each week to that side hustle? Are you going to go away and do an intensive for a few days, you know, every other month to work on the side hustle? What does that look like? Because our friends, our family, even ourselves, we need to know when we can turn that off. Because otherwise, our tendencies as an entrepreneur that's a high achiever is going to be to just work all the time. And that's because we have overvalued how much our identity comes from work, and we've undervalued that actually slowing down is something that can help us. So when we actually consolidate our time, we do better work. The research also shows that we get more done and we don't spend time on the things that really won't move the needle forward. And so I would highly suggest people say, okay, I'm going to have a side gig. Here's how many hours a week I'm going to put into that. Practice of the Practice started as a side gig when I had a full-time job at a community college. I knew that every Sunday that there would be, you know, my little kids would be taking naps, and I was a nappreneur. Sundays is when I originally did all of my podcasting. So I'd get 1 or 2 weeks of podcasting done depending on how long they took a nap. And so figuring out, okay, Sunday afternoon was when I felt I was refreshed from the weekend. It sounded fun to do. it was easy. And then throughout the week, I might write a blog post or two, do a little bit kind of on the side. But I also knew that there were particular things I had planned into my schedule that were in my free time that I wasn't going to no-show on myself for.
Yeah, I love that term, napperpreneur. It's so great because it goes to the idea that you have to find time. And when you do have it, like, you have to be super focused and you have to make the most of that time. Because look, you could know that when your kids are taking a nap, you could either doze off yourself, you could scroll through TikTok on your phone. But just knowing that you had to take advantage of that hour where your kids were napping is so crucial. And I love what you said, that people overvalue the identity that they have that comes from work. And this is something that I've been really curious about for a long time and been kind of like diving into, is identity. So how do you think your side hustle, your full-time job, if they are different, how should they align with your identity and who you believe and know that you are?
Yeah, of course we want, whether it's our businesses or our full-time jobs, to align from a value set. We don't want to feel like we're doing something that's detrimental to the world or that makes us feel icky towards the world. I don't want to be selling in a way that I don't feel good about. And if my identity is tied too much to the work that I do, that means that when I have a win, I'm going to be super excited about it, boisterous, and, you know, feel like I'm on cloud nine, which there's nothing wrong with enjoying our wins. But then if when we have a loss or we have something that is disappointing, we're going to also take that the other direction, where we're going to feel like trash and say, oh, I'm such a bad entrepreneur, I should throw in the towel, why am I even doing this? Even just today I had coffee with a guy locally, and he was telling me about how there's this group of therapists that he knows that they get together locally. And one of the things that's a regular topic of conversation is how much they think that I'm stupid, that I should not be out in the world, I shouldn't be like writing books and doing all these things. I'm like, I have a local like hate group, like what? And for a little bit there, I'm just like, screw them. Like, I got really frustrated and sad about how stupid that was. And then I'm like, you know what? That is not my issue at all. Like, that just points to the fact that maybe they haven't done the work they need to do, or they're jealous, or they have just kind of fallen into, who knows, you know? But to just be able to say, I'm not even going to let my brain go into those negative people, because I have so many people that enjoy the work that I do, I need to put that energy into them as well. And so I would just say that, you know, we want to just find that balance. And usually it's not going to be in our work world, in our successes or failures where that happens. It's usually going to be stepping back and slowing down. Because one thing, when we slow down, we know it helps your business, it helps you be more productive, but it also reveals what you don't have going on in your personal life. So if all of a sudden you have every Friday off, like, what are you going to do during that time? If you're not giving yourself permission to do email or social media posts or all the other things that really are not probably the best use of your time, like, what do you have going on in your personal life? And so maybe you need to schedule something in that. Maybe it's a painting class or an acting class, or, you know, working out with somebody, or finding something to actually put into your schedule to fill that time. So for me, every Wednesday night, I'm in an improv troupe. I laugh harder during that hour and a half than I do the rest of the week. Making other funny people laugh is one of the best things in the world. I do it only for myself. I don't really need to do an ab workout on Thursday because I've laughed so hard on Wednesday night. And it's also giving me benefits within my business. I've learned skills that can help me think on my feet differently, but that's not why I did improv. I did improv because it's freaking hilarious, and it makes me just feel good. And so a lot of times these things that we do for ourselves actually help us be more interesting and productive within our businesses.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it's, I think, first of all, you know, you made it when you have local hate groups trying to tear you down. That's so funny. But I love this idea of doing things that you're passionate about. And I was actually onboarding some new employees in one of my businesses. And one of the things I do at the beginning of these onboardings is I take 5 to 10 minutes before my presentation and I just say, hey, I want to know more about you. Let's take work out of this for a second. If you aren't here, you're not working, I'm not telling you have to work a million hours a week. I want to know, in the hours that you're not working, what you're passionate about. Tell me. And we go through And each of these seven or eight individuals told me exactly what they're passionate about. And it took 10 to 15 minutes. And it was so great because all of a sudden you see their face light up and they're talking passionately about something. And, you know, oh, I love cooking. And not only cooking, I love cooking Italian food. And I love, this is my favorite dish. And you can just hear the excitement in their voice. And one of the things that I believe having skills outside of work and passions outside of work is that it gives you that perspective. And I think you talk a lot about this in your book, is that if you spend 1 million hours a week working, you're never going to have perspective. You can't step back and say, these skills apply not only to my passion, they can be applied to my work. And I love the way you articulate it in your book of saying, hey, you need more time for yourself. You need to apply these other skills to your work so that you can be a more well-rounded person, but also a better worker when you are working. So talk to me about that a little bit.
Yeah. One of the big shifts away from the industrialists is how much our brains need to slow down in order to do our best work. And so on a macro level, we know that a 32-hour work week is as effective or more than a 40-hour work week. The most recent Iceland study looked at 2,500 people, multi-year study, multiple disciplines, and showed that a 32-hour work week was actually more productive than a 40-hour, meaning those last 8 hours are a hobby. And so then we should say, why am I spending my hobby at work? Like, I should be doing something else.
Yeah.
So we know from a macro perspective that slowing down makes us do better work. We waste less time. We're actually more creative. But even on a micro level, University of Illinois did a really interesting study on vigilance decrement. So vigilance, how well we pay attention to something, decrement, meaning it breaks down over time. And so the idea was that, you know, if you do a really tough task that's mentally draining, that by the end of it, you're going to do worse at that task than at the beginning. So what we would expect, you know, you're doing this task super boring at the end, you're not doing it as well. So they wanted to challenge that idea. And so they brought in students, gave them a very boring task where they would look at a computer and random four-digit numbers came up. And when their random four-digit number came up, they had to hit a button. So maybe it was 4312. When 4312 comes up, they hit the button. Other numbers, you ignore them. Super boring task. Do it for about an hour. At the end, there was vigilance decrement. They paid attention worse and they missed their number more often than they had at the beginning. Now, the second version of the study, at the one-third mark, they gave them a one-minute break. They said something like, you know, we put you on the wrong computer, just hang out in the lobby. They didn't have their phones or any technology, just a one-minute break. Brought them back to the middle third of the study, gave them another one-minute break, and came back into the last third of the study. Now, they found those 2 minutes that they gave them, so one-minute breaks twice, completely eliminated vigilance decrement. People were able to pay attention just as well at the end of the study as they had at the beginning. So if we think from an evolutionary perspective, our brains are here to first and foremost protect us to make sure we don't die. That's the primary thing for evolution, that we don't die. So, and procreation. And so within this situation, the individuals were leaving their environment that they had got used to, and they were coming back. So our brains then are hyper aware, and it's integrating and disintegrating from that situation. And so the brain is going to pay attention differently when it leaves a situation and comes back in just to look for danger. And so our brains have not evolved enough to know the difference between leaving the study and being chased by a tiger. From leaving a jungle and then going into a meadow, your brain is going to look to see, are there bears or tigers or things that can kill me here? And so we can use this neuroscience to actually help us be more effective within the work that we do if we allow our brains to be optimized and slow down first.
Yeah, you talk about time blocking in your book. And I think that this is a lot of what you're talking about as well. And it's really underscoring the importance of just understanding your schedule and creating a schedule that creates productivity in your day. So, I mean, are you scheduling breaks into your day, and how often, and what should you be looking at? Because, you do look and say, okay, well, 4 days a week of work, if I'm trying to eliminate one day, I do need to make the most of the days that I am trying to work. So how do you set up your schedule for each of those 4 days?
Yeah. So when I look at my schedule, I know exactly where I'm spending every single minute when I'm working. I don't have a to-do list where I'm looking at it. It's in my calendar. And so I'll even have a 15-minute section where Jess, my director of details, will go through my emails and say, here's the top five emails you need to respond to. And she'll put that into my calendar. So when I enter into my email, I don't just get sucked in. I know I have these top level things. I have a sponsor that wants to, you know, join, you know, be on the show, respond to this and send them the sponsor package. I've got this high level media thing coming through. Make sure you respond to that. And so I know exactly where I'm spending my time, down to the minute every single day. So when I show up, I run full tilt. And when I have breaks in my schedule, I frequently think about what is it that I need in that period of time. So after our interview, I know at the top of the hour on that next time, I have another interview. And so I've got about 45 minutes or so that, you know, between interviews where I'm going to hang out. I'm going to do things that are going to fuel my body. I know I'm going to have a green smoothie. I know that I'm going to eat a healthy lunch. I know that I'm going to probably step outside for a couple of minutes to help my brain reset. I might even, you know, do some dishes to just not think about work. And so figuring out what I need during those micro breaks is so important to make sure that the next interview I can show up and just run full tilt. And people do this differently. That's where when we talk about sprint types, the way that people sprint and the way the neuroscience is teaching us really points to that it's like personality types. We sometimes hear batching or sprinting, and maybe you try that and then you're like, that didn't really work for me. Well, it's because you don't know your sprint type. Your sprint types, just like a personality type, is different between different people. And there's a couple of factors that we can kind of dive into if you want to go deeper into sprint types.
So
when you think about your sprint type, the first thing is what type of work are you doing? And so the first type is a time block sprinter. So that means over a period of time, you're doing one particular task, anywhere from an hour to 4 hours, broken up into usually 20 to 30 minute segments. If you're more of a kind of squirrel ADHD person, you probably want to break it down by every 10 minutes so that you're really focused. You set a timer, you dive right in, have quick 1 minute breaks between things. So time block sprinters are just doing one major task over and over kind of within that period of time. Whereas a task switch sprinter, that type of person needs variety. Now, we're not talking about multitasking. We're not talking about doing a bunch of work that you shouldn't be doing, but it's knowing what are your top level things. So I need to have these blog posts written because it's going to help with SEO. And so I'm going to sketch that out for 20 minutes. And then I know I have these top level emails I have to reply to. And then for 20 minutes, I'm going to be on a pre-consulting call. And so you have that variety throughout your day. So first, it's do you need that variety or do you need that consistency? And then the second area is when you do this. So an automated sprinter is someone that has it in their calendar and it repeats over and over. So for example, every Thursday from April of 2020 until September of 2020, I was writing Thursday as the new Friday. And so it was just in my calendar on repeat. I'm writing the book that day. No one could get into my calendar at all during that time. Whereas an intensive sprinter is that type of person that needs to go away for a weekend. They need to go away and rent an Airbnb, go to a hotel, go to a friend's house, just get out of your environment for a couple of days. And so when you know when you sprint best and what type of work you do best, that then allows you to unlock that potential to get more done in a shorter period of time.
Do you find that people think they may be a good multitasker? And they say, okay, well, I may be this one type of sprinter, whereas they're just kind of spinning their wheels and trying to or saying they're accomplishing a lot without really getting anything done.
Yeah. So when we look at like the sprint structure we walk through in the book, one big thing is to say in this sprint. So when you first start sprinting, you want to say, what am I going to accomplish to know this was a successful sprint? Mm-hmm. And so to say, in 20 minutes, I'm going to sketch out the basic bones of a blog post. It's going to have these five main points, and I want to have 3 points under each one of them. Okay, that's how you're defining success. And then over time, you're experimenting. Maybe that's too much for you during that 20 minutes. Maybe that's too little for you in that 20 minutes. We want to be able to learn and adapt as we go, as we do these experiments. And so it may be, I'm going to try to do all of this in a 4 hour, you know, time block in the morning. And you may realize, you know what, that's too long or that's too short, or I got into flow state and I interrupted myself early and then I couldn't get back on track. We want to learn over time kind of how we can be smarter about the way that we work and then optimize those things that work for us and just ignore the things that don't.
That makes so much sense. I love this idea of experimentation and learning. And in a way, it's what computers do so well that we don't, or at least the speed of it, right? And when you're thinking about AI, it's that computers are constantly testing and learning and automating and changing at milliseconds, and they're able to do it really fast. But it's something that we as humans might not necessarily do all that well at speed or scale. So I love the idea of really taking time to step back and say, okay, what am I learning? What have I done? What was I able to accomplish? And what can I do differently? And you do also talk about technology in your book, and you said that technology has made communications work a lot easier. But then you also give a statistic saying that 1/3 of Americans say technology increases workload. So why is that? And I know that you referenced email specifically, but why does technology actually increase workload when it seems as though it makes it easier to accomplish more?
Yeah, I mean, think about the typical workplace where someone says, we should have a meeting on Tuesday to talk about the key performance indicators of the accounting team. And then someone says, okay, that works for me. I can meet at 12:30. Well, no, I can't work at 12:30. Well, how about this? And you end up spending so much time on this email string just trying to figure out talking about what we're going to talk about. You know, previous to email, someone would have picked up the phone and said, hey, we need to talk about the accounting team. Okay, on Tuesday, does noon work? No, 1 o'clock works. Okay, great. 20 seconds. And so in some situations, it becomes such a back and forth rather than just saying, let's figure out everything we need all in one email. So here's the time that works for me. Here are the things I want to make sure that we talk about. If this doesn't work for you, please respond with 5 different times that do work for you, or use a, you know, some sort of calendar app where you can look at everyone's calendars. And so I think it's that we aren't using technology in a way that saves us time. And we default to being on email for 2 hours and thinking that's work, when often it's just a conversation that could have been so much faster if we jumped on a phone call. So that's why even with my essential team members, you know, we have regular check-ins. They're not long. They're 10 to 15 minutes. But it's just a quick check-in to say, let's get this stuff done right now. Don't put it on each other's to-do lists. So I may be in a meeting with someone and they're like, will you email this person about this? I don't put that onto an email list or onto something to do later. I'm like, give me 2 seconds to just do that right now. Then you don't have to worry about it. Sure, that person is then getting paid to sit there for the, you know, half a minute it takes me to type the email, but we both know it's done. There's not the back and forth. I can say, hey, what do you want? Did you want me to say this or this? So any of those blockades just get worked out. And so there are times when just a phone call or a Skype call or a Zoom call are going to actually speed things up for you rather than the constant back and forth on email or Slack or Basecamp or whatever you use.
Yeah, it makes sense, because you also find yourself a lot of times looking at your email, writing an email. It takes a second to write an email, but then it also takes a second to reread your email, see if you actually said what you wanted to say. And then you're kind of questioning yourself, rethinking, oh, wait, is this exactly how I want to do it? And now all of a sudden you're 30 minutes into an email and you're like, this solution should have been so much faster than this. It doesn't make any sense that we wasted all this time on this.
Yeah. And then to also think through, if you're doing the same thing over and over, why isn't there a clear process for the team to do that instead of solving it every single time? So for example, you know, we help manage the Done For You podcasting I referenced earlier. And so we have a Trello board that we just copy over when it gets started. Do I do that? No, my team does that. Our you know, chief production manager does it. So we have the workflow that I do the pre-consulting call. When that person says yes, and they make their first payment, then I'm not the one that does it. My director of details then says, okay, this payment came through. She then connects with the production manager. That person knows then to set up the Trello board and invite those people into it. She does a onboarding meeting with them on how we're going to use the Trello board. All of that's outside of my own time. And so I've done the initial sales call, and then I'll do the consulting, but everything else then is automated. And so we want to continually think about, can we hand this off to a person, a software as a service? Should we just eliminate it? You know, Parkinson's law, we hear that work expands to the time given. The other side of Parkinson's law that doesn't get much media is the natural bloating of companies. And, you know, Parkinson looked at specifically the British Navy and showed that when some sort of process, system, red tape was added, it was near impossible to pull it back out. And so we have to, as business leaders, go through and say, let's refine through this. If we were going to start from scratch, would we build it this way? Or maybe do we need to say, let's throw that all out and start from scratch again and say, let's rebuild this in a different way that actually makes sense.
That makes so much sense. So you also, the point of your podcast is to help people, or let me back that up a little bit. You started by helping private practices start, grow, scale, and exit their practice. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm trained as a counselor and a psychologist. So primarily it started with helping people start, grow, scale, and exit their private practices.
So that could translate into so many different industries. And I like the idea of things kind of working the same way. So when you're talking to an entrepreneur, a solopreneur, a counselor that wants to build the best practice they can build, where are they struggling the most? Is it getting started? Is it growing? Is it scaling? Or is it exiting?
I think for the average therapist in particular, counselor, therapist, social worker, whatever term or license you're talking about, most of them enter in with two major challenges. One is their money mindset. So many of them are kind of helpers of the world, and they've often worked for nonprofits or schools or other places like that, that the idea of charging a bunch of money for therapy feels off for them. And so they have a lot to work through to realize that money's not the enemy. Money just expands what's already there. So if you're a great person and you have a thriving business, most likely you're going to help your community in a better way. If you're a terrible person and you have a thriving business, you're going to do really crappy things for the world. And so starting with that, and then also the lack of basic business skills. The average therapist and counselor has maybe taken one intro to business class if they were lucky. Most likely they have zero business skills. So they're starting with KPI. I don't even know what a KPI is. A profit and loss sheet. Like, I don't even know what that is. And so really basic things oftentimes when they're first getting started.
That makes a lot of sense. So what are the, in your business, as you've grown as an entrepreneur, what are the three biggest mistakes that you've made and learned from?
Yeah, I would say one of them would be not having an upsell or downsell for every product that I have. You know, we've built that out over time. So if someone's just starting a practice, and they sign up for a one-year practice plan. It's a one-time $17 fee. They get an automated email for a year. So we now have an upsell where if they want to join our membership community, Next Level Practice, they get access to 30 e-courses, experts like Pat Flynn. They get, you know, small groups and all sorts of things. And so it's sort of a Netflix model. So we have an upsell into that. And then it goes all the way to the very top with the Done For You podcasting, where at every phase of practice, we have something that if someone says, whoa, that's way more expensive than I want, we can say, okay, well, we have this other thing that you're going to bootstrap a little more. We're not going to give as much hand holding to you. Or they say, oh, I have more cash flow than that. Do you have anything more individualized? Yeah, oh, sure, we have this Next Step program. And so instead of what's often taught online is have your core product that you always offer, we've actually thought of it from start to finish, from the moment somebody says, hey, I want to start a practice, all the way through, I want to exit a practice. Do we have something along that entire spectrum? So I didn't do that early on. The second thing I didn't do early on is I did not create a solid email course early on. An email course is different in my mind than an email newsletter. A newsletter is very you-centric. It's here's an update on what we're doing. Here's these things. Like, nobody wants your email newsletter. But an email course, that's thought out, that's structured out differently. And the way that we teach it is your first three emails kind of deconstruct the problem from a societal standpoint. So for us, in the private practice world, why were you set up for failure as a therapist? Well, you weren't taught any business classes. You were taught these money mindsets that are unhealthy. And so we're kind of saying, it's not your fault. Yeah, you were set up for failure and we're not going to stay there. The next three emails that we recommend are having quick wins, things that your email subscriber can get a fast win, like 5 to 10 minutes. So in my space, that's, hey, go Google your town plus therapy and look at the top three Google businesses. You know, how many reviews do they have? Yeah. What do they have going on? Oh my gosh, they all have 2 reviews. If I set that up and I have 10 reviews, I'm going to rock this out. Okay, great. Now you have some confidence and you did it in 5 minutes. So having three of those in different emails that come automatically. And then the last three we recommend are long-term habits. And so these are the things that people need to do over and over, whether that's blog posts, that's podcasts. What are the habits they need to be successful? And so by having an email course instead of just some cheesy, you know, checklist or opt-in, it then helps you build that trust with people over time where it's a really substantial thing. So if you're on a podcast or if you're doing other things, you have a clear opt-in for people that they can go do. So I would say that was the thing that I should have done earlier. And I would say the third thing is most people from 0 to 100K are putting on so many different hats. They're their bookkeeper, they're their attorney, they're doing their SEO, and they're doing all these things. And then after 100K, what they should be doing is aggressively taking those hats off. I bootstrapped way too long. I did not build out a healthy team. I gave myself a job, not a business. And I think that the sooner you can start taking those hats off and saying, sure, I'm good at, you know, producing my own podcast. Sure, I'm good at marketing. Sure, I'm good at these things, but I should not be doing those things. The more you can become that top level person that's thinking super big picture, that's where you really start to see the success, because you're only putting your time into those very top level things.
Yes. I love the idea of this email course, because you're right. You go to a website, you talk to somebody, and they're like, okay, opt into my newsletter. And then the newsletter comes and it's just selling what they have. And it's like, okay, well, what kind of value does this bring me? I've already got an inbox full of clutter. I don't want more clutter. But by doing a email course, you're now providing value. And that's huge. It's also building your brand. It's also creating trust, knowing that what you are delivering is going to have value associated with it versus asking for value for yourself. So I love that idea. I mean, how do you look at this evergreen content and say, hey, you're an entrepreneur, solopreneur. Where can I create a piece of evergreen content, whether it be a masterclass, whether it be an email course? What should you be looking at to create something like that?
Yeah, I would say start with the problems you hear over and over. So with Podcast Launch School, we just said, what are the questions we keep getting from our top level people? And how do we address those through an email course so that by the time they want to buy Podcast Launch School, they're farther ahead? So now if they purchase it, what happens is they don't ask me all those questions because I already answered them. And so now we're starting at, you know, a mile down the road or 2 miles down the road instead of at the original starting point. Mm-hmm. I would say also over time, just keep track of the things that you're creating. And so you can take, you know, an awesome podcast interview, turn it into an infographic that looks great on Pinterest or somewhere else, and then bring that together into a course. People often think they have to start from scratch with everything, or that people pay attention to all of your social media. They don't. You can take things that were super popular over the years and then put them all together in an organized fashion. Even taking maybe 5 podcasts that you think kind of all connect with each other, say, hey, you know, we have this marketing series that we're putting together in Teachable. You can opt in totally for free. This is actually what we did when we realized we had so many opt-ins throughout Practice the Practice. We took almost all of them down and we bought pillarsofpractice.com. And so now at pillarsofpractice.com, it's just an opt-in for Teachable, where you can either, if you're starting a practice, you can opt in, or growing a practice. And then within it, we've got all of the email opt-ins that people could possibly want for starting or growing a practice. I did these 8-minute expert interviews where I interviewed a handful of experts for 8 minutes. I set a timer. It's the only place people can get these videos. And so there's something exclusive there. And then there's also some podcasts in there that are specific around starting a practice or growing a practice. So over time, you create all this content, then you can put it behind an email wall and say, hey, if you want access to this full course, it's totally free, but you do have to give your email so that we can stay in contact with you.
Man, that's such a great strategy. So you've obviously worked with a lot of entrepreneurs, specifically with counseling, but in many different areas, you've worked with a lot of entrepreneurs. So what's the biggest or most common, like, aha moment that you see these entrepreneurs have that may have been stuck where they were, and you share some information, something valuable, and they're like, aha, I've been missing that the whole time?
Yeah, I think that really understanding the highest level of their work. I think, you know, even people that have very successful podcasts or consulting or whatever area it seems like they're successful in, oftentimes are just working so hard. And when they start to realize, you know, if I automated someone checking my email, if I automated someone doing my social media, if I automated someone doing my show notes and, you know, transcriptions, to just realize that might cost you $500 a month, you know, it maybe. And to say, if I land one new consulting client that more than pays for that, that switch in saying, okay, I want to just do the things I'm really good at. I want to show up for podcasts. I want to do some consulting. I want to show up for my membership community. Okay, those are the core things that I, Joe Sanok, do. You know, I only have a handful of one-on-one people, got the membership community, and I do the stuff that makes sure new people find out about me and about Practice the Practice. when you can narrow that down and then have the team support everything else, for one, you're doing the stuff you love. And so it's a lot easier. You have your best energy going into all of that. But two, you're giving people jobs that they love doing those things too. And so it ends up being a win, I think, when people really make that switch.
That's such a great answer. And Joe, we could talk forever. And I want to be respectful of your time. I loved your book, Thursday's a New Friday. I think it's a great idea to reevaluate the time that you're spending on things. And I think it's also incredibly beneficial for your mental sanity, for your family, for just your passions in life, to take time and dedicate it to that. And I really think that that reboot that you give yourself is going to be valuable. And I understand that, you know, if you're working for an industrialized company and you just cannot take 5 days a week or 4 days a week and take one off, then, you know, I think that you can at least make the most of the time you have to give yourself a little bit of that freedom and then maybe go back and negotiate leaving early on a Friday or whatever it may be. So all these principles are super important. I am curious. You did mention Tim Ferriss and the 4-Hour Workweek in your book. And I think that that book is a masterclass in time optimization and productivity. Where did you feel like Tim missed or was lacking in his 4-Hour Workweek book that you felt like you had to make a similar book to help people kind of optimize their productivity?
Yeah, I think that, you know, Timothy's book is just really good for the individual entrepreneur to just think differently about time. You know, he's even said that he doesn't think it's realistic for most entrepreneurs to work only 4 hours a week. And so I think the 4-Hour Workweek was monumental at the time that it came out, just to really shift the conversation. And it was great for the individual. I would say my book is more like that, but for all of society, that the idea is that we're going to shift together. That right now, as the post-pandemic generation, do we want to say that 2019 was the best we could do pre-pandemic, that those were the best health outcomes, the best energy outcomes, the best productivity and creativity? Or do we think we can do better? Because we have massive challenges ahead of us in the next 20 to 50 years, you know, whether it's global warming, race issues, future pandemics. I mean, you name it. We don't even know the challenges we have. And do we want to be stressed out and maxed out? Or do we want to actually have that creativity and productivity to be able to put in to address whatever challenges are ahead of us? So I would say that moving from a 5-day to a 4-day, we're seeing that across the globe. We're seeing Spain, we're seeing Denmark, we're seeing Iceland, New Zealand. We see Kickstarter, Microsoft Office, Japan, all sorts of companies and countries are making that shift to at least test it out. And that's where I see that this book fits into that conversation. It's not my movement, it's all of our movement. Whereas I would say Tim's was great for the individual, mine's better for the macro.
I love that. I love that. You know, the global pandemic highlighted so many areas of need in society, and you know, the obvious ones are obviously health, right? It was very much a health pandemic, and people who did not have a good healthy foundation did end up finding themselves getting much sicker when being confronted with a pandemic like this. And I think you're right. I think that it's also highlighted the health of corporations and business and entrepreneurs and the individual worker and maybe work ethic. And look, the companies that are reliant on having employees in the office 5 days a week or more are definitely going to suffer because they are not necessarily meeting the needs of their employees in a time where we now can work remote. We can optimize our productivity and maybe work less hours and achieve more for a company. So I think that that's a great explanation for that. Joe, how can people find you, the book, the podcast?
Yeah. So the book Thursday is the New Friday. It's available wherever you get your books. I'm sure your local bookstore would appreciate the business, but you can also get it on Amazon, Audible. You can get it digitally. If you buy 10 of the books, you get access to my free Thursday is the New Friday mastermind group, where we have some top podcasters, influencers, other folks. I think right at this time, we have about 40 people that are signed up for that. And so the first third of that is going to be going beyond the book. The middle third is going to be doing some hot seats. And then the last third is going to be networking with other people within it. And if you purchase this, you know, even after that's gone, we'll have access to the recordings. So if you buy 10 books anywhere you want to buy your books, you just submit your receipt over at thursdayisthenewfriday.com. Also, joesanok.com is where all of my keynotes and speaking and writing is. We're also collecting experiments that people are doing there. So if you do an experiment, we want to learn from you. We know that as a group, we will do better than if we do this as individuals. So we're going to be reporting out experiments as they come in over at joesanok.com. And the two podcasts are Practice of the Practice. And that's great if you're a coach, a counselor, a service-based type of person. Or Thursday is the New Friday, the podcast. It's a 22-part first series where we go beyond the book with Angie Morgan, New York Times bestselling author, interviews me to really go beyond the book in regards to a lot of concepts there as well.
Awesome. Guys, check that out. Three final questions that I ask everybody on all the podcasts. So question number one. So you obviously wrote a book, and books can be impactful in so many ways. So what's the most impactful book that you've ever read?
I would say most recently, The Untethered Soul by Michael Singer. It's such a great book in regards to dealing with heavy emotions and allowing your awareness to be the thing that kind of leads you more than anything.
Oh, sounds beautiful. Second question, if you could have a drink with anybody, past or present, who would it be? What would you drink and why?
Ooh, I would say, there's so many different people that I would love to just, you know, meet past or present. I think in the context of this book, I wouldn't mind sitting down with Henry Ford and really digging in to see if he's the, maybe the villain that maybe I've made him out to be. I could be inaccurate in that area. He probably saw himself as someone that was revolutionary at the time. And so, I would want to know what his favorite drink was, and just taste it. I'm sure that in the early 1900s, there were some crazy drinks that, you know, I don't even think about. So, or to drink some like Bordeaux from 1926, like that'd be kind of cool too.
Absolutely. And then this podcast, the Every Breath Counts podcast, is all about optimizing mind, body, career, and life, but it's also about having gratitude and making just the most of your life. So how do you make every breath count in your life every day?
Yeah, I'm a single dad raising a 7 and 10-year-old, two little girls. And so I frequently have glitter in my hair, or I'm playing Mario Kart, or going for a hike with them. And so just raising the two of them to be strong young ladies, to me, that's why I don't dink around when I'm working, because I know that every minute that I'm not working, I could be doing things to support, you know, these two girls. So whether that's, you know, doing the dishes, folding laundry, you know, just making myself healthier by meditating, they're my main focus.
Awesome. Well, Joe Sanok, thank you so much for your time. This has been great. Guys, go out, buy the book. Thursday's the New Friday. Check out the podcast, The Practice of the Practice. And look, take time, reevaluate your life, find out what matters, do the things that matter, and don't do the things that don't. And take a step back and make every breath. Hey, y'all. Thank you so much for listening to the podcast. I can't articulate how grateful I am for you. If this episode was inspiring, motivating, or educational, it would mean the world to me if you hit the follow or subscribe button wherever you listen and left a positive 5-star review. And if you want to learn about new episodes as they come out, check out my Instagram at Every Breath Counts Podcast and sign up for my newsletter at everybreathcountspodcast.com. Have a great day and make every breath count.